This week on The Stack, we speak with celebrated creative director Jing Moore on his latest book, Hunks and Heroes, plus a look on how posters remain incredibly powerful as a means of communication. Stay tuned for this week's edition of The Stack. From Midori House in London, this is The Stack, 30 minutes of print industry analysis, and I am Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Coming up on the show, the importance of posters on a new tome from Thames and Hudson. But first, Jing Moore is perhaps one of the most storied creative directors in magazine publishing. For 40 years, he has helmed the look and the style of GQ, the men's magazine, which began life as a publication called Apparel Arts in 1931, before a name change in 1957 to Gentleman's Quarterly. Moore now also works as an independent advisor to brands and notable personalities around the world. Monaco's bureau chief in Toronto, Thomas Lewis, met Jing Moore during a visit to Canada and began by asking him about his new book, Hunks and Heroes, Jing Moore, Four Decades of Fashion at GQ, which chronicles his career.
First of all, I didn't want to do the book, which is kind of surprising for people, but I think it's just the nature of being, you know, a magazine creative person, where we kind of want to look forward to the next thing. And we've been, you know, on this fast track of, you know, we're shooting a cover on Tuesday and it's Friday and, you know, looking forward. So I always thought, like, looking back might be not painful or not unpleasing, but also just, you know, I've been there, I've done that, I need to move forward. And Ivan Shaw, who works at Condé Nast, an incredible photo director, said, you know, you got to make this book. And I know many people are trying to get you to do this book, but we're going to do it together. And let's start this weekend. And this was the summer of 2018. And so we started by looking at every GQ from January 1980, which is the first magazine, the first issue that I had contributed to. And it took us about 4 months to go through what I had no idea was about 32,000 images that I was responsible for. So it was something that I thought we could do in a weekend, but it took 4 months and we had a blast.
Was looking at, I guess, your life almost in review, was that sort of a horrifying thing? Or was there something pretty delightful to see how, I suppose, the steps on the ladder had sort of played out in terms of the photography and the creative direction of GQ?
Yeah, it was really interesting because I was curious to see how this was all, this kind of jumble of photographs, was going to look together. And, you know, Dimitri Levis, who is a celebrated art director, and he's the one who art directed the book, he said, you know, when I started this project, I didn't quite understand what your style was, in a way. I knew what GQ was, but I was like, what is Jim really responsible for, and what is the look and the feel of his pictures? Because when I think about magazines like Vogue, where you see the person's name on the page, so you know what a Tawny Goodman picture looks like or a Grace Coddington picture looks like, but what does your picture look like? Because I was never one of those people to put my name on the page. And he said, by going through this, I realized that you're completely non-nostalgic. Like, even if maybe you've been pushed to do something a little bit nostalgic, you'll always put a little bit of a modern twist on it. So when we were picking the pictures, I kind of realized that as I looked through it, I would gravitate to the pictures that felt a little bit more timeless and looked a little bit more modern. And for example, in the big 80s, which was never really my favorite era, I would always buck against the idea of the suspenders and the Wall Street suit and all of that, and was working a lot with Steven Meisel in those days and was kind of always looking to disrupt the equation, you know, especially Reaganomics and what was going on in the culture. So we were on top of trends like the skinny suit, or like when Armani took all the padding out of the suit and made it completely soft and unconstructed and sexy, and American Gigolo is a perfect example of that. So, you know, kind of always trying to look forward. And obviously you're in the lane of culture and you want to represent that. But probably the big surprise was, like, not a lot of great pictures in the 80s, a lot of good journalism and a lot of big shoulders and wide ties. But there is an image in the magazine of a guy in a polka dot tie and a striped shirt, which was a very GQ put together. And that was actually a rebellion against all the paisley and all of the kind of monochromatic sad shirts and ties of the 80s. So that for me, like when I found striped shirts and polka dot ties and put them together, that was kind of an example of things that I love, things that are a little bit snappy, things that photograph well, things that are not murky and people that are not sad. And, you know, some people look at the book and they say, it's quite joyful and it's quite, you know, it's quite up, you know, it's quite colorful. And I said, well, that's what GQ is. It's kind of brash. It's in your face. And you know, I love joy. Joy can be corny, so you've got to find the right photographers to do it. But I think overall, if you look at the book, hopefully there's a modernity to the pictures, whether it's you're looking at something from 1988 or 2018.
How did the sort of notions of rebelling in terms of the photographs you were putting together change in your mind?
I think it's probably where I find my inspiration, because I kind of call it the good, the bad, and the ugly. So I can come back from 3 weeks of going to the collections and, you know, within 10 minutes of walking down the streets of New York, I maybe even get more inspiration than I did at the collections or as much. And New York is a constant place of inspiration. And I guess it was about 2006. I would see over and over and over again, I would see guys making mistakes. And, you know, New York is a bastion of style, but it's like, okay, the guy got the fit of the suit right, but he's still wearing the square toe shoes. Or, you know, that trench coat just looks terrible on him or whatever. So I went to Jim Nelson and I said, we have to do makeovers. We have to just pull guys off the street and bring them into the GQ laboratory and make them over. I remember him saying, like, love the idea, hate the term makeover. So he coined it Project Upgrade. And for me, it's one of my favorite things in the book. It's a double-page spread of a before and after of a guy who was a limo driver. And his name was Joe. And he, you know, I could see underneath that suit that was at least three sizes too big for him, that he was a diamond in the rough. He needed a good haircut and he needed a suit that fit him. And people look at that spread and they think, you know, the before and the after are at least 2 or 3 months apart, because how did you get him to lose all that weight? And I said, well, you know, the picture on the left is a Tuesday and the picture on the right is a Wednesday. And he looks like, you know, a guy that is probably, you know, a little bit overweight, and on the right he looks like a movie star, very slim, and it's all in the power of the suit. So I feel like my job has always been to preach, not teach, but you know, GQ is a very serviceable manual in a way. It's hopefully we've taught guys how to you know, put their wardrobe together. Their style arsenal is one of the most powerful things you can have. It's a very judgy society. People will look at you and judge you on the color of your tie or the haircut you had, or if your beard's too long. And hopefully we're there to help them during the hardest journey, which I feel for a guy is from the shower to his closet. When he opens that closet door and said, oh boy, it's Tuesday, and do I just wear another navy blue suit, or do I really shake it up? And how do I conform but stand out at the same time? The point we're trying to make there is a way to fit in and stand out. You know, and maybe that's my new confidence, because I think guys base a lot of their fashion choices on whether they get compliments, because guys are a little bit insecure about fashion. Women are not. Women have that chip where they can jump around to different stores and put it together and do the eclectic mix. They're brilliant that way. And men are a little bit, they need you to hold their hand a little bit. And I think the reason that, you know, GQ now is showing a lot of different characters and a lot of different clothes is just to show that, you know, kind of like the shackles are off and the rules are less restricting. And hopefully that guys can kind of pick and choose and see that there's cool stuff out there, and people that they hero worship are certainly donning those things, so why can't I?
There was a story I read, I think it was the first time you photographed President Barack Obama, and you saw that he was wearing an orange tie, and you write that immediately you knew the orange tie wasn't going to work, you just didn't want the orange tie in there.
You know, in that particular situation, I knew that I wasn't able to dress a U.S. senator who was a president-elect, right? So I still brought some clothes anyways and got shut down by Secret Service, but that's a whole other story. But I did let his people know that it probably would be preferable for him to wear a dark suit and a shirt and a dark tie. Now, I'm watching his style for several weeks leading up to this and feeling that his suits weren't fitting him properly, but seeing that he had some simple pieces. And, you know, so I've got some pins in my pocket, and I'm going to take in the shoulders of that suit and make it look the best it can. I could definitely, you know, shake his hand and you know, it could be a perfectly nice, polite shoot if he kept the orange tie on and I could come back to the home office and make lots of excuses why I couldn't change the orange tie. But I've never been that person, so I'm pretty determined to get the image that defines what I think the GQ cover is. So that's what I do. That's my job. And when I saw the picture of him on the Senate floor, a live picture of him, and I was just like, you've got to be kidding me. That is exactly the opposite of what I asked him to wear. And so the message got to him, and he was able to go home and lived just a few blocks away, luckily, and grab a suit and a shirt and tie. But the way I met him was quite interesting because we're all kind of on pins and needles and excited to meet this guy who's going to be our next president. And he just walks in, and I think he just had a cigarette or something, so he was kind of, you know, feeling good and had a great swagger or something. In those days, he was kind of a chain smoker, so I was told. And he walks in with the garment, and he's like, hi, everybody, someone here doesn't like what I'm wearing, so I hope you like what's in this bag. And so that was my introduction to Obama. And then 8 years later, when I shot him, so anyways, we changed him, and I put tons of pins in the back of his suit. And then, of course, later, I was like, he went back to the Senate floor, and I was freaking out. Like, did I get that fifth pin out of his suit, you know? But years later, when I shot him and I introduced myself to him in the White House, he walked into our studio and we were there, and Inez and Vinod were there, and we were going to take this great picture, and we had, you know, 7 minutes to do it. And he said, of course I remember you. You're the guy who didn't like the tie I was wearing. And he said, by the way, you're looking at me now, looks like you don't like my tie today. And he said it with a big laugh and humor. And once again, he went home, which was just upstairs, and changed his tie. So it's just I talk to creatives a lot, and I give that example not to say, oh, I shot the president, but just like, don't give up on that moment that you know is going to make a great image.
And just as a final thought, GQ has had a change in the editor-in-chief position, I believe, in the last sort of year or so, yep. And a refresh of the mag at mm-hmm. the same time. How's that process been, and what's the reception been like? And I guess kind of what kind of statement is it, you know, from your mind of what GQ will be in the, right. I guess, the 40 years to come?
Yeah, yeah. No, I'm super fascinated with things like that. Like, I was able to really steer the magazine for many decades, and I'm a big fan of Will's. We're really good friends. He's been at the magazine for 12 years, and we taught each other a lot. I taught him about fashion. He taught me about music, and, you know, we've always been close. I think what's really an advantage to him these days is that he doesn't have to care about newsstand sales, and I think if you go back just even a few years, the newsstand is really what set your advertising rate. So how well you did on the newsstand. So if you look at kind of all the covers over the last 30 or 40 years, it was always my job to create a poster that would sell on the newsstand, a photograph that would actually look better with a lot of type on it, and an image where the guy hopefully looked his very best and was engaged and was happy to be there. And that was kind of just the mission statement for every cover. And I think now it's a different story. The newsstand, are there newsstands anymore? Unfortunately, but print is still alive. The brand GQ is bigger than ever. It's challenging just because of the state of magazines right now, but I couldn't agree more with the direction of things. And it's really fun to kind of like let go a little bit and see what's going to happen. I'm so not a person to keep looking back. I'm a person to see where GQ goes in the future, whether I'm involved with it or not.
That was Gene Moore speaking to Monocle's Thomas Lewis. Still to come on the stack, we'll be talking about the importance of the poster. That's after this from our friends Eloy Tam.
Today we continue with design legend Marina Willer. Marina spoke before about the importance of retaining a curiosity about the world. How does seeing more, learning more, how does that drive creativity, and what does her escape from routine and the mundane look like? Is it almost, by definition, unpredictable?
It's always different, but I think there are some constant things. No tech is really important. It doesn't mean you have to ban. I'm not any way you know, too addicted. I think I'm it doesn't participate in my life that much, and our children don't do tech at all, which is great. But we as a family, we connect a lot by going to places and drawing, painting, sketching. And it's not about it being good at all. It's just the pleasure of creating that space in our heads, because you can go a bit crazy if you just think you have to always see exhibitions, always do it. That's also a bit of a exhausting, because London is more and more busy. So it's, I think you need to find a balance between many things. And this stage I am, sometimes it's just about creating a bit of space to read, space to draw and doodle or you know, think. And that's when good ideas come.
And we'll conclude Marina's story, written by hand, of course, next week.
Welcome back to The Stack. The poster remains one of the most powerful and efficient means of mass communication. Its power has been revitalized in the digital age. With 300 examples of the most important posters, The Poster is a new book published by Thames & Hudson in partnership with the Victoria and Albert Museum. The book was edited by Jill Saunders and Margaret Timmers. I've met both in the studio to discuss the book and our favourite posters.
Well, the V&A from the very beginning recognised posters as a hugely important part of graphic art and design, and so it did start collecting very near the beginning of when posters were having their heyday, and has carried on collecting ever since. And it's an international collection with all the great names represented. And we're very keen to share knowledge about our collections with people through this book.
And Jill, posters, I mean, we can say that they are an art form, right?
We can, I think. Yes, absolutely. They're a very particular art form because they marry graphic design and typography with imagery. And certainly in my view, and I think in the view of a lot of those who have designed posters, the perfect poster is a kind of précis, a kind of summary, pared down to the essentials of the message that the poster, the advertiser, is trying to convey.
And Margaret, it's interesting, of course, the posters, that, you know, they changed the way they presented themselves over the years. But it's remarkable. I mean, the main thing didn't change very much, even in this digital era. I mean, even when you walk around in London, bands are still, you know, putting the you know, little posters around the city.
Yeah. I think they're very sort of democratic medium. And very flexible, so they've been able to change as we change. And in fact, one of the things about them is the way they're able to convey these messages across such a range of issues, whether they're selling products or selling travel or persuading us about political events or encouraging us to, I don't know, go to the theatre. All the time, they can adapt to the vocabulary of now. I think that's what has made them able to survive.
Very much so. Jill, tell us how you divided the book in 7 chapters, right? Can you just go through some of them with us?
Yes, we can. I think Margaret is perhaps better placed to speak about this, because
we did divide the chapters into the kinds of posters according to what they're advertising or promoting. And so we grouped them under performance and entertainment, sport and recreation, art and exhibitions, commerce and consumption for products, travel and transport, politics, protest and propaganda, and finally the poster in the digital age. And at the beginning of the book, there's an introduction written by Jill, and at the end, a small piece about the V&A collections by me. But the book is essentially image-led, so that as you go through it, although each chapter has its own introductory text and each poster illustration has its extended caption, I think it's very much the images that sort of drive the book forward. And I think one of the interesting things we found during the design process of the book was how some of the posters spoke to each other across the pages. Yes. In composition, in colour, in style. And perhaps we learned things through looking
at that. Yes, I think we did. Once you see things in a different context, you start to find out new things about them and get a different sense of how they would have been understood by the audiences of the time.
And I have to say, some of the posters here, they're so iconic. So, you know, of course,
absolutely,
I've seen them before. But you're right about the surprise. For example, I'll just give an example, one that caught my eye. I think page 58, which is by a Croatian artist, Boris Bukan, which is, I don't know, it's a woman with a face of a bird.
It's the far bird, yes.
It's the far bird. It's
just stunning.
It's stunning, yeah. Mm. And I had no idea about it before, you know. Mm. How is the market for people that want to buy posters? Because I became quite interested. I think I mentioned to you both, I would love like a Martini Bianco poster. And there are quite a lot of places that are, you know, they're selling and they're extremely valuable as well. That's why the V&A is so lucky to have quite a few.
Well, you're absolutely right. And actually, from the very beginning, posters have been collected. And one of the reasons our own collection is so rich is because people gave their collections that they'd hoarded and gathered together. But now I think there's an enormous market for posters, and you find them in online auctions, at actual auctions, through private dealers, and some shops have them for sale.
Yes, yes.
And they're still collectible. And of course, there are some that have become particularly collectible. One thinks about film posters, for example.
Yeah, film posters, that's another thing. I mean, sometimes, to be honest, I choose when to see a film if they have a nice poster or not.
Yes.
I know it's
that's the measure of an effective poster, isn't it?
Exactly.
Yes.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Do you think, for example, Jude, do you think there's much to change in posters in this digital age, or there will always be there?
That's an interesting question because, as you know, you walk around the streets of any big city, you still see paper posters and posters on billboards. That has not gone away. But at the same time, a lot of the poster format, the poster message, has migrated into digital forms. It's now online. And often ad campaigns mix paper posters on the street with a digital or online campaign as well. So I think that the poster has been, if you like, revitalized and reinvigorated by the advances of digital communication.
Yeah, if it's done smartly, very much so. But I have something to tell. For example, I think the bus stops here in London, there's one that keeps changing all the time. I have to say that I feel a little bit irritated because sometimes I want to read, what's there?
Exactly.
And then they've changed. It was, a new flavour of ice cream, and then they changed for a security insurance company.
It's true. You want to explore them further. And again, that's something that goes back in history because in the 1920s, there was an advertising exhibition, and one of the posters actually showed all the different brand characters, like the Kodak girl and so on. And people used to study these posters on the underground platforms. You were probably quite irritated when a train came along.
Exactly, exactly. Sorry, I know this is a difficult question for everyone, and I don't want to take you by surprise, but do you have a favourite poster, perhaps, that is in the book? If not a favourite, or one that you would like to talk about?
I have so many favourites, but the one I thought I would talk about today, because for me, it in many ways sums up what a good poster does, is a poster designed by Tom Eckersley. It's a poster for the London Underground, and it was to advertise the new Victoria line, which began in 1968. And this poster by Tom Eckersley was produced in 1969 to publicise the advantages of the Victoria line. So on a red background, it shows a white pair of scissors with a black shadow, and the open blades of the scissors are the letter V for the Victoria line. And the strap line is cut travelling time, and the word travelling is cut by the scissors. And it's
smart.
Just such a perfect, neat message, which is eye-catching and simple. You can understand it as soon as you see it.
It's a very good choice. What about you, Margaret? Do you have?
I had one favourite poster that I thought I'd like to talk about, which was Stille Shoes. It's a German poster by Lucien Bernhardt of 1908. And it's wonderful. Bernhardt was a pioneer of this design style called Sachplakat, or object poster, where there's a bold image of the product itself, which is the absolute focus of the composition. And in this particular poster, we've got a very dramatic image of a woman's shoe with a bow, with the brand name Stille above it, in very bold lettering. And both the image and the text were actually drawn directly onto the lithographic stone, which gives it that sort of unity. And although the black shoe is set against a sombre grey-green background, it has a vivid pink lining, and the heel has a little ochre inside to it. And there are also reflections in the shoe's leather, which makes it almost stage-lit. You can't help but fail to want to look at this poster. Probably they hope by the shoe.
It is a great colour composition. I mean, you printed a copy here in front of us. It does look beautiful, actually. So very good choices, I must add. But another one that caught my eye, there's a poster here for The Economist, I think from the 80s. Again, very simple. It's just a quote, but quite provocative as well. So yes. I think posters, actually, they can, you know, even the simplicity already can be very efficient. Yes. It says here, "I never read The Economist," and then is written "management trainee aged 42. Yeah. Very provocative. I kind of have a feeling that probably they wouldn't do this today in 2000.
Well, I think they specifically chose that poster because they were appealing to their own would-be audience who were meant to be smart and clever and want to get on. So if you were a management trainee at that age, it wasn't a very good advertisement, and it meant that if you did read The Economist, obviously, you would get on. But I think, as you say, perhaps it wasn't meant to appeal to everybody, but it was meant to appeal to their own target audience.
Yes, posters are often focused on a niche audience rather than a general audience, and that's a very good case in point.
And you know, here there's a couple of kind of political posters as well. Do you think the importance of posters reflect the world of politics as well? For example, in the last general election?
Oh, absolutely.
Yes. Not only are formal election posters put out by political parties, but also all the kinds of protest groups now, such as Extinction Rebellion, for example. The campaign by that group called Led by Donkeys, who made a marvellous series of crowdfunded posters for the cause of protesting against Brexit, for example. The poster lends itself so well to different causes, different campaigns, and individuals and groups are using the poster imagery in such a creative way. Often these are quite simple, straightforward, handmade pieces, but they're photographed, they're shared online, they go viral, and they have a real effect.
And I think that one of the crucial things for political posters, protest posters, you know, they're low-cost sort of means of production, and the speed with which, therefore, they can be got out. And they're not sort of, you know, ordering huge billboards to paste them up on. They can, again, it's back to adaptability.
Yeah, they can paste them on a wall. They can carry them on a stick in a protest march.
Long live the poster. So you want to say something?
Yeah, I was just going to say, when communism was being overturned in Central and Eastern Europe in 1989 and 90, I did actually go out and make a on-the-spot collection of some of the posters, the pro-democracy posters that were being created there across all those countries after perhaps some graphic non-freedoms in the previous years. Suddenly there was this explosion of people wanting to express their political views before the free elections in March 1990.
That was Jill Saunders and Margaret Timmers talking about their book, The Poster, which will be published on June the 30th. For now, you can pre-order the book on Amazon. That's it for this week's show. My thanks to our editor, Nora Hall. If you have any comments or queries, feel free to write to me, Fernando, at fp@monocle.com. And remember, we're back next Saturday at the same time. And of course, you can always listen again at monocle.com or subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and SoundCloud. To end the show, a nice, sunny song for you. It's by Dom Penn with No, No, No. You've been listening to The Stack. I'm Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Until next time, it's goodbye from me. No, no.